Hello and welcome to a remarkable episode of the Jazz Podcast. Today we have Supertramp's John Halliwell on the show. Today may also mark the end of the Jazz Podcast, as the copyright gods may well smite me for this, but the chance to play my favourite Supertramp song at the top of the show was way too good to resist. So Dan, this is either our final ever show, or just a really cool episode of the Jazz Podcast. Let's get to work. For anyone that doesn't know John Halliwell, he was a big-time saxophone player in the supergroup Supertramp in the 1970s. John has probably seen the whole world. But of course, this is a jazz podcast, so John has since kind of become a full-time jazz musician. And after I spoke to him, he told me later that week, I was like, oh, what are you up to, John? You know, and he was like, yeah, nothing much. I've just got this gig in Budapest with Randy Brecker and Mike Stern, you know, go and hang out with those guys for a bit.
Not a bad gig.
Yeah, agreed. And at that point, again, I was like, it's the Jazz Podcast. Let's have a listen to John. Welcome to the Jazz Podcast.
Thank you, Rob. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's really, this is our first venture into someone that doesn't have like a hardcore jazz background, if you like. You
know? Yeah, jazz has been a presence, a big presence in my life.
Yeah.
More so now than it was before,
yeah,
in terms of professional musician, making music professionally.
Yeah. Yeah, because we met in a band that is, I don't know if you can call it jazz quite, but it kind of is.
Group S.
Yeah, kind of feels like that's where it came from.
Yeah, yeah, because I think to be a musician and a saxophone player, it's very rare, I think, to find someone who's not been influenced by jazz players.
Yeah.
I would think.
It's a hard thing if you haven't, because then people just assume that because you play the sax, you can improvise.
Yeah,
you know,
I suppose so.
I see that a lot when I studied, my degree was a classical degree, you know. People just assume.
Yes, unlike, say, a flute player or an oboist.
Yeah.
Or,
it's a thing for us. If you can't do it, that's... Yeah.
What? You can't improvise. You're a saxophone player.
Exactly. So, so where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Pennine town of Todmorden. And I was growing up through the 50s, 60s. And my parents weren't into jazz at all. They were slightly musical. And I just used to hear them singing bits of Gilbert and Sullivan and classical stuff. And I took piano lessons for a year when I was 9. But that was good because then I learnt to read music.
And yeah.
And other things got in the way. But then an interesting moment occurred when a neighbour played me a version of Sidney Bechet's Petite Fleur, played by Monty Sunshine on the clarinet.
Mm-hmm.
He used to be the clarinet player with Chris Barber's jazz band.
Right.
I really liked that, and I thought, well, I'd like to play clarinet. So I eventually got a clarinet at age 13 or so, and just had a few little lessons in the hometown.
Did you like save up for this clarinet, or you, like what made you wait till you were 13 to get?
It was 11 when I heard the recording.
Yeah.
I was 13 when I bought it because I had to save up my pocket money for this clarinet.
Wow.
It was £15.
Wow.
I saved up for 2 years.
Brilliant.
So I just used to get like shilling a week or something.
Yeah.
That's in old money, which you don't remember.
Yeah.
So I got this clarinet and did a few lessons. And I was introduced to the Tomlinson Symphony Orchestra by my teacher who played in it. And just sort of just got going a bit on clarinet. And then I heard this dreadful jazz music for real on... I used to listen to shortwave radio then, and it was Voice of America. And they used to have a jazz program every week. And this guy, Willis Conover, I think his name... jazz was very sparse on the radio, as you may imagine, back in the 50s. 60s. And and I heard this dreadful jazz music and thought, oh, maybe I'd like to play saxophone as well. There seemed to be quite a few saxophone players.
Yeah.
So my first influences on the saxophone were Sonny Rollins and Coltrane, etc. I got the album Tenor Madness.
Ah, yeah.
That was good. And then I heard Cannonball Adderley and I thought, oh, man. This guy is great because he had that combination of jazz and soul, sort of what they used to call soul music back then. And
there's a swagger about his playing, isn't there?
So good, so, lovely, lovely player. So my first saxophone was an alto, which I got when I was about 15, and it sort of carried on from there.
When did you get your tenor then?
I bought my Selma Mark VI new. When I had a proper job working in Birmingham in 1964, and it was 145 guineas.
Wow.
A guinea was a pound and a shilling.
Right.
With a case.
Right.
And a mouthpiece. And I knew that it was a good instrument. I didn't know how good it was then.
Did anyone know how good the Mark VI was going to be? Because now they're like pieces of gold dust.
Yeah. And no, I don't think so. I just thought, well, I love the tenor now. And I was 18 by then, 64, 18 or 19 by then. So I'd left school and I was a computer programmer. And I was just kind of playing in my spare time. And I thought, I quite fancied tenor then. Because I've been playing this Pennsylvania tenor since I was 15. Which, so I got this Mark VI tenor. And then I was playing in groups and stuff in Birmingham at the time. And then...
Did you go to Birmingham because your job took you there?
Yeah, I left school and then I went to Birmingham just to be this computer programmer for ICL, the company.
Is that something you... Was that just for money or did you actually quite fancy that?
I fancied that because I wasn't... I didn't realise or think about having music as a career.
Yeah.
So... Yeah, so I was playing in my spare time in some groups, and there was a group called Jugs O'Henry, and we sort of turned professional and went to London. We got a few gigs at weekends, and it seemed to be quite nice. And I thought, well, I'll give it a chance, I'll give it a go.
Yeah,
and it lasted for about a year, and then the group kind of all broke up. So I was just living in a flat in London and I was just stuck there. Then I didn't know what to do. So I decided to apply for a job as a musician and I decided to apply for a job as a computer programmer. 64, this was. And I put an advert in the Melody Maker that said, "Have sax, will travel."
Great.
It was a quote from a TV show about... There was this lawman, gunman, and it was "Have gun, will travel." Have sax, will travel.
Yeah.
And I applied to a computer place, and I got two jobs. I got offered two jobs. One was with the Alan Bound set, which was an offshoot from a John Barry 7. John Barry being the film composer, wrote the James Bond sort of theme.
Oh, cool.
Right, so it was led by this trumpeter called Alan Bound. I got that job, and at the same time I got offered a job in Sweden as a computer programmer. And so then I I had to make my choice, really. So I chose to work with this Alan Bowne group. And, and we played in clubs and made albums through the 60s. And it was quite a jolt, really, for me. Innocent boy from Tomberton and just being a computer programmer for a year or two. And then thrust into the impecunious world of music with people who won't beat about the bush when they criticise you.
Yeah.
You were crap tonight.
Yeah.
I couldn't really take that. You know, I was thinking, what?
Yeah.
Why would somebody say that to me?
Yeah.
So, anyway, we had good times travelling around the country. We went to Europe once or twice. We were set to go to the States, but it never happened. And we went from one record company to another and just kind of bumbled through the 60s, really. We had a minor hit with We Can Help You, and we were on Top of Pops, and we'd on TV and stuff, but it never really took off. We all left Alan Bowne, and we tried to form a group called Wizard.
Yeah.
And this wasn't the Wizard that was formed by Roy Wood from The Move.
Mm-hmm.
You won't remember all of these people. They were a big group in the 60s. And we did a gig, and at our first gig we did in London, Fulham Road somewhere, the manager of the Alan Bowne set turned up and took all the equipment away. So we were rather stuck.
Wow.
So that group didn't go on. And after that, I did some interesting gigs like backing up visiting American soul singers.
Yeah.
Jimmy Ruffin, Arthur Conley, Johnny Johnson. And that was it. That was quite an interesting
thing. How did you get into those?
I just got to know a drummer and he had a band and we went and played with different people.
Yeah.
And then I went to Germany in early 73 to play with a guy called Pete Lancaster, with the same drummer that had been working with the American soul singers,
mm-hmm.
And worked there for about 3 months, living in Wiesbaden and playing in American air bases that are over there.
Wow,
that was
cool.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And we kind of played nice music, like. He was an organist singer and he sung a bit like Ray Charles. And so it was a lot of good music that we were playing and we were keeping fit because we had to carry the Hammond organ around and all that business and living.
Well, they must have weighed a ton.
Yeah, they do, Hammond organs. They break people's backs. But they're good instruments.
Yeah.
And then I was just getting a bit fed up of being in Germany without my wife at home.
Yeah.
We lived in Maidenhead at that time, and I called her up one day and she said, Dougie Thompson's just called from Supertramp. Now Dougie Thompson was a bass player in the Alan Bowne set,
mm-hmm.
for a year or two. Subsequently he joined Supertramp, who I had met once or twice on doing gigs here and there. They seem to be quite nice chaps. But Dougie had called and said, where's John? Does he want to come down and have a play with us? See how things go? Because we're kind of reforming and doing some good stuff.
Yeah.
So I came back from Germany in the summer of 1973. And on July the 19th, I know that because it's just passed and I found it in a diary, was the first day I played with Supertramp. They never did ask me to join. I just kept going back. And
so that must have gone pretty well.
Yeah, it was good. They just got a new drummer.
Yeah,
they'd had a couple of changes from when they started in 1969, I think it was.
How big were they at this point then?
Not very big. They'd made two albums, and they were known on the club circuit,
right?
Mostly in the UK, a little bit abroad. And they'd had a couple of changes of personnel, and they were apparently Rick Davies and Roger Hodgson, who were the songwriters, they didn't want ever to fire anybody, so they were too scared. So at a certain point, they said, oh, well, we're disbanding. So they disbanded the band, and then the next day set about trying
Brilliant.
To form a new band.
Yeah.
So Dougie Thompson was in it, and then they got an American drummer, Bob Siebenberg, and then they got me. and it seemed to be a really good combination, and they got lots of songs. And so we went to, we did the thing that you did in the 60s, 70s, and went to go and live in a farmhouse in down in the country.
Nice.
Dorset, Somerset way. And rehearsed. And then we made this album called Crime of the Century.
Yeah.
Which you may have heard of.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good. Which we recorded the next year, and we were lucky to get the services of Ken Scott, the producer, to do that.
Yeah.
And so that begins the sort of modern Supertramp story,
right,
from 73.
So you're, how long were you in this farmhouse?
We were in for...
like months of isolation.
Yeah, 2 or 3 months, yeah, leading up to Christmas, then maybe a month after.
Just rehearsing every day.
Rehearsing, yeah, it's good. It's good, yeah, to live together. We, yeah, lived on. We lived with all the group and the sound guy and other people, wives and girlfriends and baby. We lived for £20 a week.
Wow.
The whole,
yeah,
food for everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who was paying for that?
The record company.
Right.
That was really good because we,
awesome,
weren't earning anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that starts the kind of Supertramp story.
Yeah.
And the, yeah.
Do you ever remember thinking in the farmhouse, like, this will be, I guess you never, I don't know, I imagine you wouldn't get this feeling of like, yeah, this will be cool, everyone's going to love this, you know?
Yeah, we didn't know. But,
no.
But what we did know was that the music was really strong.
Yeah.
And we were, after two albums that hadn't really gone anywhere, we wanted to make a mark.
Yeah.
And the record company were very good because they gave us our, they just said, go ahead and do it. And then halfway through the recording, we were recording at Trident Studios in Soho, in London. And halfway through the recording, it was going on a bit, and the head of A&M, the M...
Yeah.
A&M, Jerry Moss himself came over to London and came down the studio and listened to our music. And that was the period where it was either we're going to go ahead or not, you,
yeah,
know. But Jerry liked it. And he,
oh, wow,
apparently said to the other people at A&M, let them get on with it. This sounds good. So,
wow,
we had our, you know, we had the facilities just to carry on. And it did take a long time, but it turned out, worthwhile, really.
Yeah,
that was a kind of concept album, and at that point we decided not to go back and play clubs. Mm-hmm. I actually hadn't played clubs with them because it was just from the moment I joined, we were just kind of rehearsing.
Yeah,
we'd played someone's wedding in Jersey.
Did they ever have, yeah, a saxophone player before you?
Yeah, yeah, there was,
yeah,
Dave Winthrop,
right,
who's now an artist.
Oh, well,
A graphic artist.
Yeah,
yeah, still plays, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had a different drummer, a different bass player, and a different saxophonist. But the two songwriters remained,
yeah,
from the original group.
Yeah,
and the original group was formed from adverts in the Melody Maker.
Wow!
So it was a good paper back then.
Yeah, yeah. Because, yeah, I imagine if I put an ad in a paper now, I can't imagine any good would come of it. You know?
No, because all musicians used to read the Melody Maker.
Right.
I mean, because there wasn't internet or anything,
yeah,
nothing.
Yeah.
There weren't even telephones.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, there were.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting times. And so we began this thing of we would only play concerts.
We didn't talk about that wedding. That's amazing. Got a Supertramp wedding gig.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. It was in Jersey. I don't know. It was a friend of a friend who said, yeah, come and play for us,
wow,
which was interesting. But an interesting occurrence musically that night, we were playing outside this grand house, and outside the house there was two cannons, mm-hmm, on either side of the steps, and one was right by the where we were playing. And so we did the first half, and Bob the drummer, unfortunately, he'd had a little too much to drink so far, so he actually wasn't playing all that well, Bob. And so at the interval, he decided that he must sober up. And in fact, never ever drank before a gig ever since, right? Yeah. So he had lots of black coffee and sobered up, and then just before the second half started, the bass player Dougie dropped his plectrum, and when he bent down to get it, he smashed his head on the cannon.
Oh, God.
So the bass was up in, in the second half. So the drums weren't good in the first half. He'd sobered up and played well second half, but the bass was all over the place. It was funny.
Yeah.
But it was just like a gig.
Yeah.
And I think it was the first time I'd flown. Yeah. Little plane.
Wow.
Jersey. 1973.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's flown a lot since.
Yeah, of course. What was it like then as the gigs were getting bigger? Like for you, you know, just personally, like, you know, I can't imagine.
Well, it happened gradually. It was good because we did, in 74, we started out and touring Crime of the Century. And it was nice because we were playing in places where we made it, if it wasn't a theatre itself, we made it theatrical because it was presenting this album. And it was a dark stage and quite dramatic. Mm-hmm. And the music was quite dramatic. And we got as far as we could, really, touring the UK. And we did a few gigs in France and Belgium and abroad. We played to 6 people in Paris. At the Bataclan, in fact.
Wow.
The place that was terrorised.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we had quite good crowds in this country. Mm-hmm. And then we thought it would be great to go to the States, so the record company helped us again, and we started to make inroads in the States because a couple of the songs had been played quite heavily on the radio, which was quite good.
His record company must have had a lot of faith in you guys.
Yeah, and they were really good to us. We owe them a lot.
Which company was it?
A&M.
Oh yeah, sorry, the M and A. Yeah,
the A is Herb Alpert,
right?
And the M is Jerry Moss.
Right.
They don't exist anymore, but both guys are still around.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. So, we started in the States, and we started to build up, really. But sometimes you use subterfuge and evasion to try and get people to gigs, like doing a radio interview, and then the DJ says, right, we've got 2 pairs of tickets for this gig this evening for the first callers to call in. Of course, we've got dozens of tickets. So everyone who calls in gets a ticket.
Idea.
Oh, congratulations! Yeah, you've just
you've
made
won.
It. And so they call it papering the house. So you get more people in. But the first time people came, they came back again because we did a really good show, and we liked it to be sounding like a giant hi-fi.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it grew gradually through the 70s, from 75 when we first went over there, and we went to live there, you see. And then we made another 2 albums, and then we made Breakfast in America. We made that in 78. And
where were you living?
We were living in Los Angeles.
Right.
I lived there for 17 years.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah, so it built up, and then Breakfast in America was really popular, especially in the States then.
Yeah.
It got lots and lots of airplay and whatever, and then it became successful in Europe too, especially France.
Wow.
And Spain, Germany.
Wow. Right now this podcast is huge in Japan.
Right, so we went to Japan once. We should have gone more often. Because Crime of the Century made a bit of an impression.
Right.
And I think Breakfast in America.
Maybe this will help seal the deal.
That'd be good. Yeah. Yeah, we can go back and play there again.
Yeah.
It built up. So you say, playing to big audiences, it grew.
Yeah.
So it grew from playing to 6 people or 3 people, gradually up to...
It's nice to know that you had those situations, only because everyone I know has had them.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, I've played to no people. At Bradford or Leeds University with the Alan Bound set.
Yeah.
And it's one of those where there's other groups playing, you know, and we were in this room, and by the time it came time for us to start playing, there was nobody there.
Oh, man.
And I think eventually one or two people just turned up.
Yeah.
It was weird. But we played anyway.
Yeah.
We had to.
Yeah.
But it's funny playing to no people. There's no vibe.
Yeah.
You've just got to make your own vibe. Yeah, but it built up, especially through the 70s, and until the tour in 79 was about 9 months long and quite exhausting, and we took some time off then. But we'd recorded at our gig in Paris, we'd recorded three of maybe four nights to 10,000 a night or whatever it was, which was really good. And we made an album called Paris, which was good. So that tided us over a few years. And then we started again in 83, which turned out to be the last tour of Supertramp that Roger Hodgson, the songwriter, was on.
Yeah.
So it was kind of his farewell tour. That was the biggest in terms of audiences, and especially in Europe. We played really big venues in Europe then.
So. Did you know that was his farewell tour at the
time? Yes, yeah, we knew it was his farewell tour. He said goodbye to the audience every night.
Really? It was funny. Oh, wow.
So, and then we carried on without him. We actually had a vote in the band, and we want to keep on playing with Rick, no problem. Yeah. So we carried on through the 80s, and obviously not as popular, because we never had massive hits again like we'd had in 79 or 80 or so with Breakfast in America.
Yeah.
But we carried on through the 80s, and at the end of the 80s, we'd made two or three albums, and then there was a period where Rick Davies, who was the main singer-songwriter, decided he wanted just to sit back for a bit, and there was a hiatus, and I got a bit itchy feet and did a few different musical projects, and then I decided I would like to educate myself musically.
Right.
Maybe it's time to learn to play the saxophone. So I applied to the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester and got in by the skin of my teeth, apparently, because they said they were full up.
Why the Royal Northern?
Because then I thought maybe I could go back to my hometown and live there.
Yeah.
And then just study in Manchester, commute up to Manchester. Oh, which wow. It worked for a while till I got... We, as a family, we got fed up with Tomlinson, so we moved out. But I continued to go to the college. But I didn't complete my course. I did 3 years of a four-year course.
Oh, wow. I couldn't remember.
Yeah, it was 92 or so until 95.
Yeah.
And then some work came up. I got a gig with Roger Hodgson, in fact, doing another of his solo projects where we did some gigs and a live concert which was recorded. And then Rick was ready to make another Supertramp album. So then I went and recorded the Supertramp album, and then we did a tour. So that kind of put paid to the college education.
Who was teaching you at college?
Neville Duckworth.
Wow.
Started teaching.
Cool.
Well, I was with him all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was the guy that taught Rob Buckland.
Yeah.
And
he taught me a bit when I was at school,
Did he?
Yeah.
When you were at school?
Yeah. He used to take our, saxophone quartet lessons once a week when I was, 12.
Oh, great. He was old-fashioned. He was one of the saxophone players that had come up when saxophones was kind of almost banned by the classical type cognoscenti.
Yeah.
And they could only sort of almost play a bit of dance music, you know.
Yeah.
And, it was interesting. So I studied saxophone, which I'd never done, really. And then I played in a big band with Clark Rundell conducting.
Yeah.
And then played loads and loads of squeaky gate music, modern music, which I found very interesting. In fact, in my first year, I was thrown into this. Reading is not my strong point, as you will have heard. but it did get a lot better. And in my first year, there was Martin, the tenor player, was playing in the wind ensemble and everything. But he kept turning up late. So Tim Tim. Tim, who ran the wind orchestra, mm-hmm. Tim Rhenish, fired him and said, John, you're in.
Great.
Because I played tenor, you see. Yeah. Tenor was my main thing.
Yeah.
So I was in this music, which, wow, 7/8, what the hell's this? Yeah. What's that? Jazz is very rarely played in 7 or 3 or 11, whatever. So it was quite an education. And then I learned all about classical music. And mm-hmm. I was on my way, I think, for a first. Yeah. It was good. I was getting good marks. But it was interesting playing with all the younger people.
Yeah.
Good.
It's really cool.
And I had a bit of life lessons to tell people.
Of course, yeah.
Because I've been through quite a bit.
Yeah.
I've been through an extra 30 years of playing that the others haven't.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that about music conservatoires, though. Like, when I was studying, there were guys that were in their 40s on the course.
Yeah.
You know, especially like the master's degree, that's not really an age specific thing at all.
Right.
And everyone comes from such a different perspective. But when you were at the Northern then, because it was an undergrad degree, so were most of the other people like sort of fresh out of school?
Yeah. We were in line for joining the Students' Union, and there was a few people in front of me, and the first question from the whoever it was, date of birth, you know, and it was like 73, 74, whatever, and I said 1945.
Yeah.
They all burst out laughing. But they were all young, except Mike Hall was there studying. He wasn't studying for a regular degree. I think he was on a master's, because he'd come into
2 year
course. He was younger than me, but
yeah.
He came in when he was about 30, and I was closer to 50.
Yeah.
So, So I met a lot of really good musicians, some of whom I'm still working with.
Yeah.
Through, not necessarily from the college, but were playing in Manchester, and like John Ellis, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mike Walker, I met.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people. That was good. Then I started a jazz group of my own and started to do gigs, which morphed in the early 2000s into the group called Creme Anglaise.
Yeah.
Just because I needed a fancy name for it rather than the John Halliwell combo or something. Yeah, so that was good.
Yeah. There's an album of that, isn't there?
There's an album, which was recorded about 10 years ago.
My mum has that album. She's going to be listening to this like, I can't believe you asked him if that's an album.
So it's been an interesting life.
Yeah.
So I came back to live in this country then at the early
90s. What was that like, early 90s, back to Britain after 17 years?
Yeah, 17 years, and it's from Malibu almost to Todmorden.
Yeah.
It was interesting. The weather's not quite as good, but it's a bit more real. Here, and we like it. You can't plan. You can't plan to have a game of tennis in 3 weeks at 10 in the morning on the 19th or something.
No.
You've just got to take your chance that it's not raining.
Yeah.
But the beer's better.
Yeah.
Not that I'm a massive drinker, but I like a good pint.
Yeah.
And then we had the opportunity a little while ago. We lived in a house in a place called Kirby Lonsdale, and it was opposite the pub. It's great.
Great.
Just walk out and have a pint.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, that was nice. Now we moved back to the countryside, which we're a bit happier in the countryside.
Right.
Fields, where you look out and see fields, but no pub, really. But
yeah,
you can drive to it.
You got to stock up.
Then you've got to just have one pint to drive home.
Yeah. Yeah, the countryside sounds really appealing to me. Certainly one day.
Yeah. For some reason, I just wake up early, so it's perfect for me.
Yeah.
I get up at 5 or 6 in the morning, just sort of naturally.
Yeah. You know?
And to look out the window and see sheep and a few cows and green fields, it's rather nice.
Does that not make you want to get a dog?
My wife's allergic to dogs.
Right.
So, yeah, we would.
Yeah.
We would. We just got a field next door too, so which one of the local farmers keeps his sheep on. So that's nice.
Yeah, sheep are great to watch.
Yeah,
like a screensaver because they don't really do anything. But
they've been making a lot of noise this last couple of weeks because the farmer came and took some of the lambs.
Oh no!
Yeah, took them to market.
Right.
Da da. Yeah. And the mothers. Oh, they just don't know where... They're looking for the lambs all the time. They're wandering around, bleating.
Oh, that sounds horrible.
Yeah, it's not upsetting, but it's quite funny. Yeah.
Not making you a vegetarian, then?
No, not exactly. I do like spring lamb.
Have you ever eaten one that you know came from that farm?
No.
Okay.
No, I haven't. We've eaten some beef that's come from that farm, but I didn't actually personally know...
That's great. There's such a hypocritical thing being a meat eater, you know, because like I feel bad and yet I still like we're gonna probably go like get like a chicken sandwich in a minute, you know.
Good.
So long as I haven't like met the animal, it's okay.
I think I haven't done it myself, but I think every meat eater should make a visit to an abattoir or a chicken farm or something. At least once to see how it's done.
Yeah,
you might be put off,
but that's really that's such a nice idea. Actually,
I think you should because I think you can put it out of your mind.
Yeah,
but I don't think you should.
No.
Yeah, it's what our distant ancestors did. You know, they throw a spear at an ox or a sheep or. Or break a chicken's neck.
If you were going to eat, you'd have to kill it.
Yeah. So maybe everyone should, at least once in their life, kill an animal.
Yeah.
And eat it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I
would probably do it if someone forced me.
Yeah. I went to a Maasai tribe last year. Me and my wife, we go to Kenya every year.
Oh.
We run like a music project there.
Great.
And these Maasais, when they come of age, you go and live outside the village for 2 years in the wild, and the point is if you can come back alive then you'll be useful to the village.
I bet you would.
But and everything they eat they have to kill themselves, you know,
and they go out without any money, presumably. No credit card.
You're allowed to go back to the village if you're starving, like to get a cow and take it out, but you have to slaughter it and I don't know, you know.
Deal with it
and cook it and whatever it is. And then, of course, you have to stop. I asked one once, like, you know, if a lion comes in, surely you're like, oh, crap, there's a lion in the village, you know. And he's like, no, we live with them for 2 years and you learn the weak spots of the animal and how to deal with it. He was like, you can't be a Maasai and be afraid of a lion. That's ridiculous, you know.
Gosh,
I know. Great. I was like, "Oh, it's a real man."
Yeah. What would we do?
Yeah, I know. For a day, it was really interesting. And of course, they don't have phones or TVs, or their whole way of life is just so much like they just live outside and they talk to each other. And they live on the land and move around.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
It's really interesting.
Some really good things about it. We've got so many false things that we do.
Yeah.
Don't we?
Yeah.
I think I'd find it hard to lead a cow away from wherever it was and yeah. just have to kill it.
Yeah. Just oh, you've goodness. Just got a spear and that's... Yeah, I know. But then, like, you know, it's an interesting experiment. Like, how hungry are you going to get?
Yeah.
Before you decide you're going to give it a go, because human instinct will sort of get the better of you in the end. But
yeah, you're starving. You'd have, yeah. You'd have to, or you
yeah.
die.
Yeah, yeah.
I suppose.
I like your idea a lot, though. Go to an abattoir once in your life and kind of face up to what it is that, because it's really easy when you go in Tesco Express, like you say.
Sure.
Put it out of your mind and just yeah. cook it. I'm starting to become quite a big fan of tofu.
Yeah.
Because it's, like, if you cook it well, it tastes great.
Yeah, it can do. Yeah, absolutely. I'm not... I always describe myself as a vegetarian meat eater as well, because I'm not averse to vegetarian. In fact, I go and eat in vegetarian restaurants yeah. quite yeah. a lot. So, yeah.
They're always really good vegetarian restaurants. The ones I go to...
Are they?
I feel yeah. like you have to cook it well, because it's vegetables. There's nowhere to hide.
No, that's true.
You know, so the standard of it as a cuisine is pretty decent.
Yeah, and at least, interestingly enough, when you're buying a vegetable, like you buy a cauliflower or something, there it is, it looks like a cauliflower. You know yeah. it's a cauliflower.
Yeah.
But if you buy meat or yeah. whatever, it's either in a sausage or
yeah.
a hamburger patty, or it's wrapped up in something. It doesn't really look like
no.
anything like the no. animal, does it?
No, the only time I guess it would is if you bought like a whole salmon.
Yeah.
And get served on with the head on now and then.
Yeah. Yeah. That's or good. You have a hog roast where you see the whole
pig
all the
of course.
Crust up with an apple in its mouth.
Yeah.
Poor thing.
I know. It's barbaric, isn't it, when you think about it?
Yeah. Yeah, well.
What about people that only eat fish but not meat? Do you have an opinion about that?
I don't mind them.
Because I find that
doing that. You think it's double standard?
A little bit, just because it's in the water.
And yeah, and you don't know whether the fish is in. Are they in pain when they get?
Probably. They probably suffocate. It can't be
nice. It's probably nice. Not nice to die, is it? Like a fish, yeah, no. suffocating. But they don't make much of a noise, do they? Whereas, like a cow or a would.
Because fish don't have like voices.
Yeah.
No food with a voice. I've never heard that before.
Oh, that'd be an interesting diet, wouldn't it? Nothing that has a voice.
Yeah.
But I do eat fish myself and like it.
Yeah. Talking about fish.
Yeah.
Did you have a favourite country when you were touring? Somewhere that you'd really be super excited to go to?
Yes. The States was good at the end of the 70s and then the early 80s. And then that dropped off quite a bit, the sort of public enthusiasm for yeah. Supertramp. But it never did drop off in France and Spain.
Right.
For example, Portugal. Especially France, they still love us. And so to go there and to walk out on stage in front of however many people it may be, and they're so up for it.
Yeah.
Because they so love the music. And then whenever they recognise the first few bar or whatever of a tune, they're really excited. See, you've got a good start there.
Yeah.
They make you more enthused and you generally give a better performance.
Yeah.
Not always so, but at least you know that they're really enjoying it. So it's nice that. So you get a really good vibe.
Yeah.
No matter how many people there are, really, but it is good if there's enough to get quite exciting, a roar from a crowd.
Yeah, so definitely. Good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can imagine. I'm sure we'll be getting plenty of that tonight.
We'll have that tonight, yeah with Group S. Yeah. There's a few people that are really happily looking forward to this gig, by the way. So great to... my association with Andy Scott is very interesting, because Andy Scott and Rob Buckland, they both went to the Royal Northern and learned there in the Apollo Saxophone Quartet, the very, very finest saxophone players that you can imagine.
Yeah.
But interestingly enough, Andy, his inspiration for starting to play the saxophone was listening to one of them was listening to one of my solos.
Wow.
Supertramp solo.
Yeah.
I think the Logical Song.
Wow, that's awesome.
And so, interesting situation many years later that I would come and play with him as the band leader.
Yeah.
It's been a nice vibe because there's a great deal of respect going both ways.
Yeah.
So, it's nice. And the same with Rob. I think he was inspired by listening to my saxophone playing with Supertramp.
Yeah.
So, it's really nice to know that.
Yeah,
and it's been such a great way to make a living, really, and that's to just what we do as musicians. Basically, we give people pleasure, don't we?
Yeah,
that's what we do.
Yeah.
So, so many other people do jobs that really don't have much of an impact on the way people think. But I think being a musician is great.
We are really spoiled.
We're blessed.
I feel like that. Yeah, like. When I go teaching, every lesson, like, it's important. It's great to work with kids. And
because you're helping them, they're getting better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you're playing, I mean, I guess, you know, pleasure's the main aim, but you can kind of make people feel whatever you want. Depends how you play.
Oh, of course. You know? Yeah. Well, yeah, when I say pleasure, I mean it's... people listen to music, and most people like music. For all different reasons, of course, but it's, they do it because they want to do it.
Yeah,
whatever is happening in their brain when they're listening.
Yeah.
So it's good to do that, something like that.
Yeah, you're never tempted to go back to computer programming?
No. Even though the money wasn't good for ages, it did get better after a while.
Yeah.
And also that's one nice thing that is having the success with Supertramp has enabled me to do some other things more recently that I don't have to go out and play to actually earn a living, so I can just do some of the gigs that I want to.
Yeah.
So I go and play with some people on the continent occasionally.
Yeah.
And the odd gig with my jazz group.
Yeah.
And then the odd gig with Group S is just nice for me.
Yeah. It's amazing. I think it's a luxury to try and create, but I've tried to do that with teaching.
Good.
To take only gigs that are ones where it's fun to play, you know?
Yeah.
Because otherwise, I just can't think of anything sadder than... I used to get it when I do loads of like weddings and functions, and I kind of be practicing all week. But then at the weekend, I'd be like, I'm not really sure why I'm doing all this practice because nobody's, like, really listening or, you know, start to feel like it doesn't make a great deal of difference, which isn't a great place to be.
No, don't want to be dispirited, do you, by playing?
That's my excuse for not having any gigs.
I haven't done many weddings.
No. No, I had to retire from weddings. Because unlike teaching, with a wedding, you don't get anything back, ever. Because it's a standalone event with people you never see again.
Yeah,
of course. With a student, I tend to find I make about the same money teaching as weddings. There's not a...
Oh, good.
Group, not a bit. If anything, teaching pays slightly better.
Yeah.
But you see the same person every week. Like you said, and you see them improve, and that's kind of much more...
It's good for the soul, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So... if you were starting now as a saxophone player, what kind of genre of music would you imagine you'd want to play? What would you want to do with your saxophone?
It'd be jazz.
Yeah.
Because that was a prime motivation for getting me going.
Yeah.
And playing, although I played R&B and pop and rock, and it was always with a jazzy influence. So I would like to... I think I would head for the sort of jazz, but keep it eclectic.
Yeah.
Because I'm not really a purist. I can see other things come into my brain.
Yeah.
Not necessarily saxophone players. I love to listen to guitarists. And, but it's generally in the jazz sphere.
Yeah.
But some of the jazz I like is a lot more open, and it's not particularly right down the the line. Although, I mean, I like hard bop and Art Blakey and Miles and stuff from the 50s, but I also like Weather Report and groups that bring influences from other types of music. And I like musicians that are quite open, like Bill Frisell, for example, on guitar. He plays so many different things. And then just thinking of saxophone players, I like people who can play with different genres, like Peter Erskine, the drummer.
Yeah,
because he can do jazz, he can do rock, he can do Steely Dan.
Yeah,
and I used to love Steely Dan.
Yeah, Mike Brecker was quite a good character for that kind of thing with the saxophone, able to maintain his individual style, but across quite a few different...
He'd play with Paul Simon, which is beautiful.
And
he'd do his... He'd play with Pat Metheny, and he'd quite out stuff, really, farther out than I would dare to go.
Yeah.
Or want to go, perhaps.
Yeah.
But yes, he was a very complete musician.
Yeah.
Sadly missed.
Yeah.
Mike. Yeah. I never met him.
No, I didn't, and I never saw him play live either. It's really annoying.
I saw him once. It was so good. He was actually at the Wigan Jazz Festival, and it was with his quartet, piano, bass, drums, and for the encore, the drummer came and played cornet or trumpet, and Mike Brecker came back and played drums.
Cool.
Really, really well.
That's amazing.
Oh, dear.
That's
just
amazing.
Thinking, my goodness.
Yeah.
We're slogging away just on one instrument just to try and get good. And here's he's playing another instrument.
Drums,
one he doesn't even really... You never heard it.
No.
Never heard of him playing.
It's funny how that... Like, I remember Bob Mintzer came to the RNCM and did that. Played the bass, played the drums, played the piano.
Oh,
you know,
really?
Showing everyone how he wanted their part to be.
Oh,
and being quite fluent on those. And when Chris Potter came, he came up to the jam in the student union and he played piano. And I remember my friend Tom Taylor, who is he's a jazz pianist, and Tom was devastated that Chris was so much better than him.
Yeah.
But I wanted to be like, well, of course he is. He's Chris Potter. What did you expect?
I've seen him a few times. He's not the heir to Michael Brecker, but he's that rounded a musician, isn't he?
Yeah, I kind of feel like he just went a different tangent rather than so much of a direct
influence. Yeah, he's his own man, but what a great sound and great facility.
Played some skunk with him once. That was quite an experience because of like a Brecker tune, you know, with the Chris Potter take on it. It was really cool, I gotta say. And I like that in like Chris Potter's playing, that there's a fundamental, very solid technique. Tuning is great, you know?
Yeah.
And then I kind of wanted that as a jazz player, some grounding of being very good at the saxophone.
Yeah.
Essentially, just at the technical fundamental problems. But unfortunately, when I got onto that jazz course, all of the guys on it had an unbelievably good technique. I thought that would be my like secret weapon that I could destroy people with. But they were all just...
They all had a good technique anyway.
Yeah, this guy Nadim Tamori was already like in his third year, and he just was like faster and more gentle, more dexterous. I was just like, oh no, you've got to be kidding me, you know, back to the drawing board.
He was wearing running shoes and you still had your boots on.
Story of my life, John. When I was 18, I didn't know what I wanted to do. You could go to the RNCM and try everything.
Just do everything, yeah.
Play in the wind bands, play in big bands, have every experience. And then, like, Chris Potter's showing up, but still not a jazz course, you know? It's a real...
Yes, it was partly like that. Yeah, when I was there, that's a good thing. And it was great for me for big band. I'd never played in a big band.
Oh, wow.
And I'd been influenced by jazz and loved big bands, you know, but never done it and never read that. So it came to sort of reading music late.
Yeah.
Reading music well.
Yeah. Late. Do you still have that tenor?
No, I in 1997 in New York, I found... another one, which I think is just slightly better, which I've got
right
here. And I kept it for a while, and I thought, well, somebody should be playing this.
Yeah.
So I sold it, interestingly enough, I sold it to a guy in Paris who I'd got to know. And this guy is a bus driver and a photographer and a saxophone player. And he plays in a Supertramp cover
band. This is so good. What a great place.
He plays the same solos that were originally recorded on it. A Crime of the Century, Bloody Well Right, etc.
I believe you found someone to buy it.
Yeah.
Like that. That's amazing.
And he uses it now, and we call it my saxophone still.
Wow.
He says, and when if I go, I've done it once or twice.
Yeah.
I've gone to Paris, and I haven't needed to take my tenor because I just take a mouthpiece.
Brilliant.
And I could play my tenor.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's still a good one. That was the 145 guinea one.
Wow. Great. That's awesome.
Yeah. So I still see it occasionally.
Yeah. I think it takes a lot of bravery to have your saxophone for so long, find a better one, admit that it's better and buy it. You know, it's quite easy to, I think, put the blinkers on and be like, no, no way.
Yeah.
You know, this is it forever. But, you know, that's a testament to your constant drive to practice and learn and improve.
Yeah, I'm always trying to strive to get better.
Yeah.
Although I don't practice enough at the moment, but that's just... I don't have an excuse. Yeah. My excuse could be I'm semi-retired, man.
Yeah.
I don't have to practice just as much.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's the thing about music, isn't it? When are you going to relax? At what point is it, you know, everyone's going to be burdened with this forever?
Yeah, and I don't think that I've lost any of the saxophone playing facility yet. But if I feel that I'm losing it in some way, sound quality or whatever, I think I would just retire.
Yeah.
And not play again.
Yeah.
I like playing clarinet, so that's something interesting.
Yeah.
Something different, and I've just started to pick up that a little bit more. I'd like to integrate it more into some of my jazz gigs.
Yeah.
I did a gig at the Manchester Jazz Festival last year, a duet gig with John Ellis, and I brought my clarinet along for that and did two or three numbers.
Oh, lovely.
On a clarinet, which I quite like.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the more you can do, the easier it is to sort of integrate them.
Yeah, well, I started off on clarinet.
Yeah.
And I play clarinet on one of the Supertramp hits, which is the track Breakfast in America.
Yeah.
So I was kind of known for playing clarinet, which is kind of interesting in a rock group.
Definitely.
There's not many clarinet solos in rock music.
No, I can't really think of any.
No. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I quite like that. If you play C sharp in the lower register of a clarinet, it's like G sharp on a saxophone.
Yeah.
And then you play any of the notes below it.
Yeah.
You've got to take your finger off to play any of the notes, but if you don't on a saxophone, you can
Oh, you can't?
No.
That's an interesting... Yeah, you just mash away and...
It wouldn't. You just go, and it just closes up that key.
Yes.
But it doesn't on a clarinet, and it kind of tricks me occasionally when I'm trying to improvise or play something.
Yeah.
So I'm looking for a clarinet with a articulated C sharp, G sharp.
Oh my goodness! Well, that's going to be our campaign then for this summer. We'll find one for you, John.
It's got to be a good clarinet.
Yeah.
I just wrote to the guys at Selma because I know them.
Yeah.
And they gave me one of their saxophones, the Axos, the new alto. It's a new alto they came out with a couple of years ago. So I've got this nice little relationship with Selma.
That's great.
But I emailed them a couple of weeks ago, and they haven't replied. I think maybe all French people go away on holiday in July,
August,
or something.
This is nobody in the factory. Yeah. Nothing is getting done.
Yeah. So maybe they'll reply to me.
I'm sure they will. That's awesome. John, thanks so much for coming on the Jazz Podcast.
You're welcome.
What an honour it has been.
I hope you can pod.
Oh,
I can.
I can. Let's go get some lunch.
Yeah, let's do it.
Sweet. So, Dan, he has some pretty wet and wild views on, being a meat eater. Meat responsibly. Mm. Oh, my God, that's a great slogan.
Oh, I see what you did there. You added an M to the start of eat.
That was a genuine mistake, but meat responsibly is what I call the Jazz Podcast field trips that we're going to do to the arboretums.
Arboretums?
Is that what they're called, where they kill cows?
No, an arboretum is one of those kind of parks.
Oh, like a tree museum.
Yeah, I guess so. You mean like a slaughterhouse, do you?
Yeah, that's all I mean.
Okay.
Okay, so yeah. Let's start running these field trips anyway.
An abattoir is what you're thinking.
An abattoir. Nice work. Mm. Wow, man. Abattoir. Yeah. Nice touch. Right.
Do you eat tofu?
I love tofu, yeah. I've become really a big tofu guy.
I like tofu.
It's a beauty, isn't it?
Linda McCartney, it's not tofu, but check out Linda McCartney's veggie options. They're really good.
Okay. What's your favourite tofu dish?
Oh, anything Thai. Anything Thai curry.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Thai curry tofu.
I had some tofu at a Vietnamese restaurant the other night. It was outstanding. They make it themselves in the restaurant.
Oh, well. Have you ever tried to make tofu?
No. Is it hard?
It's hard. Whenever you make tofu, make sure you have to like push it a lot and like push all the water out. I didn't do that the first time, and I had to start again. And I had about 10 people to dinner.
It was not good. Hard.
Anyway.
Right. So on that note, next week is Nick Smart.
Oh, so, we've got him down, have we?
Yeah, it's pinned down. Nick Smart is coming. This show has been one of the ones that we've been chasing since like day one. So it will be an historic moment.
I never know whether it's an or a when there's an H.
No, I think it's an historic moment in this
context.
Yeah,
because it's kind of like a silent consonant, isn't it? It
bothers me deeply, but I'm just going to do it properly.
I think you're right. I think you're good.
Yeah. And the Jazz Podcast is on Twitter and Apple Podcasts. If you can, if you want to follow us, we can be easily followed. And please review the show on iTunes. Got some amazing reviews. It makes
Have you had any good ones recently?
Can't remember, Dan. I'm going to look that up. Next week, let's read out a few.
Okay.
I'll be allowed. So if you want to write a review this week, I'll read it out next week. And then, what more could you possibly want?
I'm struggling to think of things, but I want more.
Oh, marvellous. All right, it's time to go.
Great.
We will see you on Friday.
Pleasure. Nice to have you back, Rob.
Oh, yeah, thanks, Dan. Great work last week. That was a killer show with old Montague.
Did you have a good holiday?
Yeah, it was nice.
Mm.